Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly analysis of major economic events and trends, the forces, both national and global, that shape our jobs, incomes, taxes, debts, what we buy, what we pay, in short, the economic dimensions of our lives. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my life at several universities. Currently, I'm a visiting professor in the graduate program for international affairs at the New School University in New York City. I also write columns of economic analysis for the website truthout.org, a courageous source of independent news, news analysis, and commentary daily. Do check them out. As I always say at this point in the program, please use our websites, two of them, whose names I'll give you in a minute. If you're interested in this kind of analysis, if you want to pursue more of it and connect to the links and sources we use. But I also this time want to make a special invitation about our websites. We are in a few days going to be sending out our newsletter. And in that newsletter, I've prepared and written a kind of year-end analysis of what happened in the U.S. economy in the year 2013. And I thought you might be particularly interested. If you go to our website, democracyatwork.info/action, you will be able to sign up for the newsletter and get not only this year-end 2013 newsletter, but all the newsletters that we issued during the year that bring highlights of what we're doing to you. And again, to entice you perhaps to go to democracyatwork.info/action, I wanted to mention that I will be perhaps in your area. On the 15th of January, I'll be speaking in Berkeley. On the 16th, at the University of California, Riverside. On the 17th and 18th, at various locations in Los Angeles. So if any of you are listening and might be interested, check out the newsletter, check out our websites, and you'll find the specifics of where that'll be. The other website, besides democracyatwork.info, is my older website, rdwolf.com. Not only will they provide you with information, not only will be able to sign up for the newsletter, but you can also send us, as we always ask you to do, your comments, your criticisms, your questions. We pick a few to deal with at the end of every program, but we read them all and we use them to shape and design the programs we present to you each week. And lastly, please remember to follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, something that's obligatory for folks in my situation these years. Okay, before we have our interview with my guest, whom I will introduce to you shortly, a few quick updates about things that have happened in the last week since our last program. First of all, once again, this new Pope, Pope Francis, has made some statements that a program like ours cannot but attend to. This time he was preparing his annual, or the Pope's annual, World Day of Peace statement. The World Day of Peace for the Roman Catholic Church is on January 1st. And he called again for a sharing of wealth, I'm going to be quoting from him, and for nations to shrink the gap between rich and poor. To read you precisely the words, he attacked a, quote, widening gap between those who have more and those who must be content with the crumbs. He attacked outrageous high salaries paid by top executives. And he once again reminded us of his comment that unfettered capitalism is, quote, a new tyranny. It's interesting, given the direction of politics in the United States and elsewhere at the highest levels, that the Pope is swimming in a different direction and has kept up swimming in that direction for quite a while. Other items in the news. The Republicans and the Democrats reached a tentative budget deal. But it's, of course, a long way between the tentative deal they reached and actually voting on it. So please, as you read the newspapers and listen to the media discussions of this deal, be aware it hasn't been struck yet. Just a negotiating team came up with it. But there are a couple things that have to be said about it. First, it does not increase spending in the United States, as some coverage has suggested. It simply reduces the cut in spending that's already in effect. The sequester, that statement, that weird name for cutting spending, is still in effect, and about 61% of it, that's the estimate, has been reduced. So we still see the Republicans and Democrats, in a time of extreme economic suffering, not spending more, which would be the logical thing to do, but spending less. Not as much less as before in this deal, but less. Interesting also is the continuing taboo on taxing the rich. In this deal, there is not one iota of doing that, even though Gallup and other polls indicate a vast majority of Americans support doing precisely that. And perhaps worst of all, part of the way they are quote-unquote paying for the spending that they're now doing above what the sequester had is, of course, by cutting spending elsewhere. If you're not going to raise taxes, you have to come up with the money some other way. And here are three of the major things they're doing to get that money in this deal. Raising the tax on airplane tickets, there's a stunner, and forcing federal employees to contribute more than they have in the past for a pension that is not increased. In other words, shifting the burden of paying for the pensions onto the workers and off of the federal government. And also, and this is touching at a time of two wars that we're engaged in, reducing military pensions. So we see a bizarre taking away of the people who can afford at least in order to continue to cut spending, just not as much. And once again, those at the top, corporate and private individual wealth, escape with no cost to themselves, which is the bottom line driving all of this. My second update that I want to talk to you about comes from the Journal of the American Medical Association, Psychiatry, that part of the profession. I was struck by some numbers in the latest issue of that journal. Here's what I was struck by. Psychiatrists accept insurance in the United States, both private insurance and Medicare, much less than the profession of doctors generally. So here are the numbers. 55% of psychiatrists accept insurance, and that includes Medicare. That means almost half of all psychiatrists do not accept any insurance, including the government insurance. It's even worse when it comes to Medicaid, the insurance for poor folk. 43% of psychiatrists accept it. That means the majority of psychiatrists basically will not accept insurance from poor people who obviously then cannot see a psychiatrist because they can't pay for it themselves. It's remarkable. Even the new law, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, which requires insurers to cover psychiatry and psychological services in a way that they haven't in the past, still leaves open the loophole that a psychiatrist doesn't have to accept any insurance, and a majority for poor people do that. At a time when everything from Newtown, Connecticut on over suggests that we have a crisis in our society and a need for real proper preventative and curative mental health services, it's very distressing to understand that half or more of the profession that delivers those services is unavailable to people without insurance because the insurance doesn't work. Even if you have it, the doctor doesn't accept it. Next update. I have been overwhelmingly affected by the noise, and that's the only word to call it, coming out of Europe, that they have a success in their austerity program. As I have talked about on this program many times, the European governments, just like the United States government, are busy in a time of economic crisis, mass unemployment, which is worse in Europe than it is in the United States. Not only are they not hiring and providing jobs, they're actually imposing austerity, cutting jobs in the government, cutting government spending, and claiming that that's the necessary solution. Well, it has made matters worse in Greece, in Spain, in Portugal, and that's admitted even by conservatives. But in a desperate effort to suggest that austerity at least works sometimes, somewhere, the country that has been picked by the leaders of Europe and echoed here in the United States has been Ireland. And the reason is that this weekend, Ireland is finally paying back the debts it had and going off of the dependence on official loans from the European Central Bank, the European Union, and the IMF. And this is considered to be a great success because it means that Ireland now is back in a position to keep paying its foreign creditors, because that's always been the issue. When the banks of Ireland collapsed, the government of Ireland took over the banks, and it guaranteed all the debts of the banks, all the bad loans those private capitalist banks had made in the many billions of dollars. They ceased being the obligation of a private bank and became the obligation of the Irish government. And in order to pay off all of the creditors who had connived with the banks to give them the money with which they made the bad investments, in order to deal with all of this, the government has been paying off those creditors. And now Ireland has done that enough so it can go into the private market, borrow more money to continue to pay off the creditors of those failed banks. But of course, for the government of Ireland to do that, it has to find the money someplace. And so it has imposed an austerity, savaging the country of Ireland and its economy and its people, giving them much, much less than they got before, and using the money saved on the Irish people to pay off the creditors, both Irish and foreign, of those failed banks. Should sound familiar since it's happening elsewhere. But is it true that Ireland is a success story? And the answer is an unqualified, not even close. I'm going to describe to you now, based on an article in the New York Times this last week, so that's my source, what the conditions are, roughly, in Ireland, of this austerity that is so satisfactory to the investors and the banks that lend to the Irish government. Let's go, and I'll go quickly. First and foremost, unemployment in Ireland this week, 12.8%. More than one out of eight Irish workers is without work. Homelessness is up 20% since 2010. A study by Growing Up in Ireland that tracked 11,000 families with young children, and hear me on this one, found that 67% could not afford basic necessities and were behind on utility bills, rent, and the mortgage. I'm going to read from this article since I couldn't say it better. Consumer spending has been flat. Two-thirds of homeowners in Ireland have not paid their mortgage on time for the last 2 years, according to the Irish Central Bank. Half of all loans to small and medium-sized business are in arrears. And here's the stunner of stunners. Over 200,000 of Ireland's population have emigrated, left the country, since 2008. With a population of 4.6 million people, 4% of the Irish population has been driven out of the country by the conditions imposed. 20% of children now live in households where neither parent works, the highest rate in the European Union. If that's a success of austerity, God help us with all the other failures that are admitted to be worse than this so-called success story. When you read that Ireland is a success, hold your nose. One more we have time for. There has been a problem in a series of discussions we've had on this program having to do with government redistribution. That the government intervenes in the economy in a whole host of ways, for example, by a progressive income tax that takes a higher percentage from the upper incomes than it does from the lower, by means of a minimum wage, much in the news these days, that puts a floor below which you cannot employ people. These are governments intervening to redistribute income. And this has a number of problems. First, it requires a vast and expensive government bureaucracy to administer it. Number two, there's every incentive for everyone who plays in the economy to evade these mechanisms. So, for example, it's famous that wealthy people and corporations maintain accounts in the Bahamas, in Bermuda, in safe haven, tax haven places around the world, precisely to escape these redistributive taxes. And likewise, all kinds of shenanigans are done, particularly with immigrants, to evade the minimum wage law. And these are rampant and involve millions and billions of dollars. Finally, there's this silly debate between conservatives who don't want the government to intervene and do that on a philosophical basis, and liberals who do want the government to intervene and do it on their philosophical basis. Well, here's a suggestion. We have to redistribute income because we kind of all understand, excepting the very conservatives amongst us, that the initial distribution is out of whack. Unacceptable for economic, political, cultural, moral, religious reasons, for example, those articulated by Pope Francis. So here's a radical thought. Why not arrange for a systematic change so that we distribute income in the first place much more equally, because that would eliminate any need for contentious, expensive, and ineffective efforts to redistribute. One of the reasons I support worker co-ops, the notion that workers can and should democratically run their own enterprises, is simple. If workers together distributed the profits and the income of corporations, they would never have done it in the unequal way that is the norm in a capitalist system. And the reason you change the system, among many, is to have a more equal distribution that will remove the need for the government to enter and redistribute anything like what it does now. Perhaps some residual role if extremes arise, but it would be sharply reduced, and we wouldn't have to have the silly debates, the expensive bureaucracy, and the contentiousness with which redistribution happens. Okay, there are many more updates, but as usual, we are going to shift over now to the other part of our program. So it is with great pleasure that I want to introduce Professor Jennifer Klein. Welcome to the program, Jennifer. Well,
thank you for having me.
Jennifer is a professor of history at Yale University. She's the author of two award-winning books, including most recently, Caring for America, Home Health Workers in the Shadow of the Welfare State, a book recently released that is co-authored with Eileen Boris. She writes and teaches on U.S. labor history, political economy, and social policy. Her articles have appeared in the following publications: Dissent, New York Times, New Labor Forum, Labor Notes, and CNN.com. She is senior editor of the journal International Labor and Working Class History, in which I have also occasionally written things. So, Jennifer, let's get right to it. I have spoken on this program fairly often about the remarkable differences between how government responded to the Great Depression in the 1930s compared to the response of government to the current so-called Great Recession since 2007. In short, one might say that in the 1930s, there was an attempt to deal with the crisis from below, creating Social Security, unemployment, the welfare state as we know it. Whereas in the last 6 years, under both Bush and Obama, it's been trickle down from above. Can you help us, based on your labor history research, your book and so on, give us some idea of why this difference in your mind between how we are reacting to these two great breakdowns of capitalism?
Well, I think you have to keep in mind that, and we all have to keep in mind, that just because there are bad economic times doesn't mean that people respond in a politicized way. So what is it that enabled people to take that kind of action? And if we think back to that moment, there were a set of ideas in place. There was an organized left and there was a state that was provoked, as you say. So first of all, there was a notion of industrial democracy that had been building through some new unions and among liberal progressives. The idea that there had to be a democratization of industry. People had to be able to participate in the decisions that would affect their health, their safety conditions, and that also the workplace itself could no longer be a rights-free zone. So as Louis Brandeis put it, the Bill of Rights also had to enter the workplace. There had to be freedom of association, freedom of petition, free speech in the workplace. So that idea of industrial democracy was something that was there. The other thing that was there was a strong organized left. And they were prepared to actually step in as there was a tremendous amount of disgruntlement on the job, as people were squeezed more, as people were unemployed, as the unemployed took to the streets, and actually helped turn those into real marches that took people to state capitals, that took people to the national government, and began to put that pressure on the state. And the other thing was, in fact, a responsive federal government. So people pushed the federal government from below, whether they were in unions or not, whether they were marching as unemployed people or whether they were marching off the job. And the first response of the New Deal was the National Industrial Recovery Act and the NRA. And that came in and it said, okay, business is going to be able to collude and pull together to stabilize prices and production, but that means workers can do so too. And you put the blue eagle in the window to show that you're cooperating. Well, this really sent a signal to people that, wow, the state is behind us, and I have a set of rights. I have a set of rights to act in organized form, and we have a set of rights to demand a minimum wage. And even John L. Lewis from the Mine Workers said, you have a right to form a union. Roosevelt says so. Well, Roosevelt might not have said that, but there was then a huge strike wave in 1934, a mass strike wave, especially through industries like textiles. And this really provoked the federal government to take action in permanent form. The NRA was temporary legislation in a way. And so the government responded with the National Labor Relations Act in 1935, which really gave legal standing to unions, which said that collective bargaining is going to be an essential part of this economy. And it was going to do two things. One, it would create that constitutional order within that previously private, insular realm of the workplace. And the other thing it would do is, I think you kind of alluded to this in your opening, is it would redistribute what people at the time called purchasing power. Workers had to be able to be consumers who could buy the stuff that the economy created. And so if you're going to reduce the conflict in the economy, then actually unions would be an essential part of the functioning of the economy. But just because there's a law at the top doesn't mean that business is going to recognize it, and it doesn't mean that that's going to be the reality on the ground. There still has to be power on the ground. And so business, in fact, was not prepared to recognize that National Labor Relations Act and that right. And so then you get another round of dramatic strikes, such as the General Motors sit-down strike in the winter of 1936-37, when workers took on the biggest corporation in the country. I mean, this was concentrated power. And when people saw workers win that battle against that level of concentrated power, that was dramatic. That really set off not only the notion that people had power on the ground, but also it set off unionism in all basic industry. And so we have to think of that period as being a dynamic interaction between people organized on the ground and the state, and it set up new rights of citizenship. And the other component here was not just industrial democracy, but economic citizenship, defined in terms of security. It's defined in terms of participation, but also security. The Social Security Act, the Fair Labor Standards Act, support for housing. And so this really set up the new expectation that as citizens, you would be entitled to a pension in old age, unemployment if you couldn't work, you know, assistance to get through the hard times. And so people were invested in the notion that security was not only something that they had built, but it entailed an element of public power. So you have this combination of industrial democracy and
security.
Economic citizenship and security, and it's backed by a supportive state. And the notion that unionism is essential to make this economy work again. And that moves into World War II as well.
So that's wonderful. But then it immediately makes everyone, I'm sure, listening to this, want you to answer the question, why not now? Why is now, or the last 5 years, why are they so different? Why can almost none of what you've just said be affirmed about this period, given that it's our own history a few decades earlier?
I know, it's when you were talking about Pope Francis, I was thinking, when Franklin Roosevelt ran for re-election in 1936, he said, most of the corporate leaders in this country have nothing but hatred for me, and I welcome their hatred. And I thought, you could never see this from any Democratic politician today. Instead, I think they would be falling all over themselves to say, I fear, you know, corporate hatred, and I want their money, and I welcome their money. I think that, first of all, we have had a generation of ideological assault on the notion of Keynesian stimulus, on the notion of workers' rights as being essential to this economy, on the idea that, in fact, having higher income for people is what makes the system work. Instead, we've had a generation telling us that, well, we should have cheaper goods and therefore lower wages, and that that's the combination, rather than a high wage economy that makes people afford the goods. And that the Democratic as well as the Republican parties have become allied with business, and they've changed the notion of risk. And maybe we should think about what kind of happens after World War II to answer that question. So we think about, okay, so you get the establishment of, you know, a welfare state and strong unionism through World War II. Coming out of World War II, you know, a third of the American workforce was unionized. I mean, it was at its peak in density. So, and you had this very social understanding of risk, that everybody at some point would face this point where they no longer had income. And so as citizens, as part of the economy, they would get some support. So what happened? Well, first of all, you do get a, you know, solidification of the welfare state. People believe in the Social Security Act. They had built the New Deal, and they had won the war on fascism. So there really is a legitimacy for the federal government. But after World War II, you get a Red Scare and McCarthyism, which not only purged the leftist organizers out of the unions and affected the real, you know, dynamism of the unions as social movements, but it also went after allies whom they had in government, especially women. Women who, in fact, were working on things like universal health insurance, expansions of Social Security, labor rights and labor policy, Fair Labor Standards Act, even Native American rights. And so they were also purged by the Red Scare. So the allies on the ground and in the state.
Just help us understand, how did the Red Scare particularly, or why did it particularly target women?
I think, one, because they were, in fact, actually working on social democratic policies. And so these conservatives, whatever party they were in, would actually use the term the femocracy. And they would deride the welfare state by talking about it as womb to tomb support. And so they really could use
this. So it was
a
kind
this.
Of misogynistic or sexist wrapped up with the anti-communism.
Exactly. And so that actually purged, you know, a number of key people who were there who had been part of that project in the New Deal. The second thing was the South and the South's determination to preserve its racial oligarchy. And so, again, this has a twofold effect. First of all, it limited the union movement. So that big industrial union movement that emerged in the 30s in the Midwest, in the Northeast, in the West, as it began to try to move down South and really organize through Southern industries like textile, Southern textile owners were able to just flout the NLRA with impunity, to raise, you know, scares that this might mean racial equality. So they subverted in that way. But also, Southern Democrats were very strong in Congress. They had a lot of tenure. They sat on key committees. And these so-called Dixiecrats now became the allies of Republicans to check the further expansion of the welfare state in Congress. So what you had was, you had Social Security pensions, you know, there would be additions to that. New people would be brought in over the years. Finally, African Americans who were agricultural workers would be brought in gradually over the 1950s, disability. But things like health insurance would not be added, anything that changed the scope of it. And the Taft-Hartley Act, which kind of combined the two with the, it also purged the left, and it set up these right to work, you know, possibilities, which,
to constrict the unions.
Exactly. So what you end up having is a sort of ghettoization of unions regionally and sectorally, the union movement. All of these depoliticize the unions.
Right. And so there, one way to summarize it, we're going to have to take our break, but one way to summarize it is that after the war, there's kind of a reaction, there's a profound reaction to demonize the left and demonize the unions regionally, industrially, legally, so as to, in a sense, really roll back what had happened.
Well, to contain the power so it didn't grow anymore. So if unionism and collective bargaining grew because it had the strong support of the federal government, now the effort was to depoliticize it and to contain it. And so what you got in the United States, in contrast to countries in Europe, was a kind of collective bargaining that was as narrow as it could be. One firm, one union. And at the level of one firm, one union, who's got the power? The firm had the power.
As we take our break, I can't avoid a historical thought. The language of the United States in its opposition to socialism and communism went by the term containment.
Oh.
And you are pointing out that the same people had a domestic policy that could have had the same name because it was an attempt to contain, which suggests something in common that the two have, and maybe we can return to that. We're going to take a short break. Everyone, as you know, and midpoint in the program, please stay with us. We'll be back in a very, very short time.
Sitting on a barbed wire fence. Oh. Well, my temperature rises and my feet can't walk so hot. Yeah, my temperature rises and my feet can't walk so hot. Arabian doctor comes in, gives me a shot, but wouldn't tell her what it was that I got. Killing me alive. not even 25.
Welcome back. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, and we're talking with my guest today, Professor Jennifer Klein of Yale University, a history professor there. And we're going to be talking about her book in a short while, but as we work our way toward the recent research she's done that's in the book, I wanted to continue our conversation from before the break and ask her, given what she said about what set in motion the constricting and the containment of the American labor movement, how does she, as a historian who has studied this, how can she help us understand the 50-year decline of the labor movement of the last half a century that has had such an impact on people listening to this program, on everything about our society and our economy? Help us to get a sense of how that all happened.
Well, the union movement, as I said, was kind of contained to certain industries. So it remained, you know, in basic industry for a while. And we shouldn't think of it as solely a declension story, because the other thing that happened was in the 1960s, there was a new surge in unionism, and that was in the public sector. And that really was part of the civil rights movement. Public sector workers were left out of a lot of the rights of the New Deal. They were not included in the National Labor Relations Act. They were not included in the Fair Labor Standards Act. And so for African Americans, for women, for Latinos who worked as janitors, who worked as school cafeteria workers, who worked as hospital workers, they really had remained outside of that realm of economic citizenship that had burgeoned with the New Deal and World War II. And so while the industrial unions began to struggle as industry started to move south to get out from under its contracts, or even started to move out of the country, there is a surge with this new union movement of the 60s in public sector unionism and as part of the civil rights movement, and started to win for them some of these basic rights of employment that we take for granted, like the 40-hour work week, pay for overtime, days off. There were hospital workers who would have to work for 12 days at a time without any time off. And so those movements are happening simultaneously. So we don't want to see that. But in the 1970s, first of all, as industry was automating, and we also have to think about whose jobs it was automating. It was often automating the jobs that African Americans had so recently obtained, as in the auto industry, or as it was moving. The other thing that emerged in the 1970s that is crucial to this story is an anti-union law-busting industry. Law firms, management consulting firms, industrial relations firms that were hired by companies specifically to help them bust strikes, bust unions, avoid union elections.
These had not existed in earlier in American history?
Well, you certainly had, you know, the Pinkertons, and you had the security business, but it really begins to take off through law firms and through these industrial relations firms in the 70s. And There were actually a couple in the earlier period, but it really becomes a widespread industry. And frankly, they start getting away with it. Because now also what you had was a couple of decades of management, again, especially in the South, figuring out in how to undermine the NLRA, how to begin to use the National Labor Relations Board, not to empower workers to actually vote for a union, but to use the union certification process to actually derail unionism. And that's what these specialists did. And so I think what often happens is people will say, you know, if Americans wanted a union, they would just go out and vote for one. Well, actually, it's very difficult to do that in this country, that there are enormous roadblocks to being able to do so. And businesses, both in the private sector and in the allegedly nonprofit sector, such as hospitals, are allowed to get away with all kinds of captive audience meetings, which were allowed by the Taft-Hartley Act, with firing the activists, and then just figuring I'll get a fine down the road, but you get a very small fine for doing that. So I think we have to really keep in mind that
the playing field has shifted.
Right, and that there has been a continuous kind of all-out assault on both the ability to join a union, but also the very notion of solidarity, the very notion that you would try to address problems in a collective way, and that collective power is something legitimate. And I think this comes back to also notions of risk. What the welfare state does is that it enables us to understand risk in social terms. If you're unemployed, it's not because of your individual failure, it's because there's a structural problem with the way the economy functions. And so we come up with a structural response, unemployment compensation or Social Security. And the same thing is true in terms of how you're able to act on the job. You know, just because you're one individual within a lone, you know, as a lone individual within a massive organization doesn't mean I have a voice, right. You know, and people understood that collective power in that period. And I think that has been undermined.
Seems to me there's been an ideological campaign pretty ferocious in this country, and more so than almost anywhere I know of since the Second World War, to undo the very things you talked about, the notion of the legitimacy of economic democracy and the notion of the legitimacy of security as a citizen. Those things had to be undermined to enable to push it all back. But in the interest of time, which are always a problem, let me turn to this book that you co-authored, Caring for America, Home Health Workers in the Shadow of the Welfare State. Given all that you've told us, situate for us why you chose to write a book about home health care workers and how that fits in to the larger picture of what's happened to the welfare state, the labor movement, and so on.
Well, first of all, they're currently the fastest growing occupation in the nation. So the work that these home care workers do, they take care of the elderly and the disabled in their homes and enable them to do to stay at home and not go to institutions. This reflects what our economy looks like now as a service economy. And
how many people are we talking?
We're talking over 2 million workers.
Good.
And they are the workforce is 90% female. They are women of color. Now it's increasingly immigrant women, although for a long time it was African-American women and also Caribbean women. Now you have Asian women, Filipinas, Eastern Europeans, a number of groups doing this work. And they are also women who were disfranchised and seen as at the margins for so long. They were not included in Fair Labor Standards Act. They were not even seen as workers, and the home was not seen as a workplace. And so we wanted to get at, you know, who is a worker? Who has the rights that we assume that people have in this country when they work? And so here are people who are actually working and don't have the status of employee and don't have these rights and are working for below minimum wage when nobody is supposed to be working below minimum wage. And
with
so,
no control on their right. conditions of work most of the time.
But as you've had married women go into the labor force, or women on their own go into the labor force over the last 30 years, and there is a deficit of care in the home, and you've also had people come out of the hospital sicker and with shorter hospital stays and going home, and an emphasis on deinstitutionalization, this labor needs to be done. And so these women are actually doing the work of the welfare state and the private welfare state. And so what once were seen as very marginal kinds of labors have now become central to our economy. They're central to the mass medical system. And they actually, the work they do is central to all of our questions. We have an aging society. We have a neoliberal restructuring of public services. We have a medical system that can keep people alive much longer. We have the need for disability rights. We have immigrant issues and immigrant rights on the table, and home care gets at all of that. And the kind of unionism they built had to come out of community organizing, because there's no common workplace. There's no General Motors right. this time around.
No
right?
factory.
There's no, right. There's no U.S. Steel. In fact, many of these women had no idea that tens of thousands of people were also doing the same labor. And so it's through the process of unionization and community organizing that they came out and they found that other people were doing this work. Other people were doing caretaking and began to see not only what they do as worthy labor, but also as political, because it is connected to state support. It's connected to Medicaid and other systems of state
Medicare.
Support. Yeah. Exactly. And so what they did was, because they were not legally recognized as employees, they began to turn the welfare state itself into their terrain of social struggle, and realize that basically you have to make the argument that better care and better conditions of labor are linked. And to form social alliances with the receivers of services, usually those are the people who are foremost in our mind, is the people who need care. And they don't talk about the workers. The workers were in the shadows, as we say in the title of our book. But what the workers have said is, since they've become political and taken action collectively, they have come out of the shadows and they say, we are invisible no more. And so they're beginning to reinvent what it means to organize, what it means to push for a new set of social rights. And we have to really change our fundamental terms of the of how we think of the economy. I think this is good for your show, because what they do defies our very notions of production. In many ways, if they're taking care of an elderly person approaching the end of life, this job could end with the death of a person that they have cared for months, for years. So what they produce is human care. They produce kindness. It has emotional labor, but it's also physical labor.
Right.
And so it's a combination of very physical tasks and intangibles. And this kind of defies our very notion of production, right? And so it forces us to have to rethink things in terms of interdependence.
I think also there are other streams, if we had more time, where there's a recognition of emotional labor as, like these workers, having been in the shadow, that there are almost in every job, there is an emotional labor component. Think of a waitress, think of a retail clerk, think of all the interactive jobs where part of what you're doing mm-hmm. is not just bringing the piece of pie and ice cream to the table, but it's how you interact with that customer that's as much a part of that experience as eating the pie. And that emotional labor is crucial across the board of many, many industries. Research. That's
that
wonderful.
Is why, yes, that is why I think this is so important, is because this is what a lot of jobs look like now. They are no longer the exception. They are the norm. And so they are also trying to push now and say, we need to get back to that conversation about labor standards, economic security, economic citizenship, and what form of power is it going to take to get there? And in the case of the care workers, it's not just that kind of third party of the customer, as in sales, but there's also the family, and sure. there's the welfare state.
Yeah.
And so the welfare state is critical to this. And we need to really think about this as we have an aging society. And, you know, we have this really ties into some basic issues about American ideology, about liberal citizenship always trying to define things around the independent individual, right? And so they look at people who are on any form of public assistance or need or care, and they say that person is dependent. Yeah. And if we
and
could just move
deficient.
Them, right? And if we could just move them to some fictive state called independence, then all these social problems would be solved. But what we actually have is an interdependent society.
Right.
And so I think care really has to be seen as a political model as well as a social model for where we need to go.
Well, as usual, and even more than usual, I wish we had much more time to deal with this. But let me recommend that you have heard now from Jennifer's own mouth some of the reasons why taking a look at caring for America has to do with more than health, home health care workers, but is really about rethinking the direction of the whole country at a time when it's desperately and urgently needed. Thank you so much for coming and sharing your work with us.
I'm glad we got to have this conversation.
Good. In the remaining time, and we don't have much, a couple of your questions that I can try to answer. One that many of you wrote to me about, probably is all we have time for, has to do with what I said about the Boeing Corporation last week. I pointed out that Boeing has gotten billions of dollars in concessions from the state of Washington simply by threatening to consider to go to the Carolinas and leave Washington, a standard ploy of corporations who can always, in our economic system, threaten to leave a city, a town, a county, a state, go to someplace else in the United States, or for that matter, abroad. And the threat of that, losing all the jobs, losing the tax money to the local political authorities, devastating the local communities, stores, and institutions, is such as to extort, and there really is no other word to use for it, concessions. The state of Washington gave billions, and as soon as the Boeing Corporation got it, it turned around and asked for more billions from its unions, particularly the machinists' union. And to the surprise of many, the machinists voted, no, we don't want to give these concessions. We've given enough. And I made the comment that my discussions here about an alternative so that the union does not only have to sit and bargain over how many concessions, with the union hoping to make it fewer and the company hoping to get more, that there is an alternative. And the alternative is to say goodbye to the company and run the enterprise as a worker co-op. And that if the unions were willing to go in that direction and make some successful examples of it, it would give the corporations pause because they would be in a whole new situation where they haven't been before. They couldn't get the concessions because there is an option for the union movement. And some of you wrote in and said, well, there are problems with this. Of course there are problems with this. I wouldn't pick the Boeing Corporation, big and powerful as it is, as the first place to go. There are other corporations, smaller and easier for workers to take over. But Boeing has to be among those that are considered. And some of you asked questions that I think I need to answer. For example, Boeing has intellectual property rights, patents and trademarks, and how would you deal with that? My answer to that is, where there's a will, which is the first thing we need, then there will be a way. If it's understood that workers taking over an enterprise is an alternative when the enterprise is threatening damage to the workers and their communities because you don't want to suffer that and be always on the short end of that kind of situation, then, for example, and it's just an example, think about the power of eminent domain being creatively used by Gail McLaughlin in Richmond, California, and causing such a fuss. Why not the state of Washington or the city of Seattle using eminent domain, and this time to take what property? The patents and the trademark. Those are private property of Boeing. Take them and run it as a worker co-op. You don't have to have the problem. Pay fair market value. Stop making concessions of the state of Washington to a company that will fold them into their own profits. Make some concessions from the state of Washington to a worker co-op of people from Washington. If the union wants to give concessions, but to something that is now run as a union enterprise. In this country, we give concessions to corporations who say thank you very much, and we get nothing back. The recent end of the government holding of GM stock is a perfect example. We gave them $50 billion of our public money. We ended up losing $10 billion in the deal, and all the benefits go to them, and we have nothing. Europe, at least, they take shares in a company. We'll return to this topic. We've run out of time. Thank you again. Please take a look at the websites rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. I want to thank Jennifer Klein again for joining us, and I look forward to speaking with you next week.
Things gonna change. Your time now, baby. After a while, gonna do mine, gonna be mine. One of these days, baby, I'm mourning, droning, baby. Try. Won't be long, long. Thing gonna change. Sometime in the middle of the night, I get so lonely, so lonely, so lonely. Thing gonna change. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Thing gonna change. Further on up the road, baby. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change. Change, baby. Your time now, baby. It's gonna be my time, babe. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.